Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. With me today is Dr. Neil Goldsmith. Neil is a psychotherapist and counselor in private practice in Manhattan and Sag Harbor, New York. He is also the author of a book, Psychedelic Healing, The Promise of Entheogens for Psychotherapy and Spiritual Development, published by Healing Arts Press. Neil is also the speaker, curator, and MC for the Horizons Perspectives on Psychedelics Conference, where he and I will both be presenting next weekend, October 9th through the 11th, in New York City at the Cooper Union on Saturday and the New School on Sunday. There is also a reception at the Urban Museum on Friday evening, which is free and open to the public. Further information and tickets can be found at horizonsnyc.org. Welcome, Neil. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Neil, I'd like to ask you, first of all, to tell us a little bit about the Horizons Conference, your role in the history, and then we can get into some issues about parenting.
Great, great. Well, thanks again for having me. And the Horizons Conference is next weekend, Friday the 9th through Sunday the 11th, and it's packed with mostly research-oriented, but not academic. You know, it's meant for everybody to enjoy and understand, but it has to do with fact-based evidence, research about psychedelics, about their role in medicine, their role in psychiatry in particular, about their role in changing society, some of the policy issues and policy conundrums in dealing with the reintroduction of these visionary substances back into society. Mm-hmm. So that's what the Horizons, it's called Horizons Perspectives on Psychedelics, and it's horizonsnyc.org. And you're speaking there, I hasten to point out.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, well, it's an exciting topic, really, and it's one that's not often talked about. Your topic, unless you've changed it, is Reclaiming Religious Freedom and Family Values, a conversation on psychedelic parenting.
Yep, that is correct.
Wonderful. So Horizons tries to be a little edgy, and the whole topic, of course, is a bit provocative and edgy.
Yeah.
So, and we want to talk about, you know, how you deal with this very issue, as do you, with, you know, the very real need to consciously address the issue of how do you deal with this borderline between legal and illegal and, mm-hmm. and salacious and holy,
right.
with your children.
Yeah.
So I praise you for doing it, and
thanks.
I'm really happy that we could bring you into the conference.
Yeah, and my goal is to hopefully in the future maybe get rid of some of that edginess and salaciousness and have it be seen as, you know, we go to ceremony just like everyone goes to church on Sundays.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, of course, absolutely. Yeah.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about how you got started in your work, and then we can talk about your family life.
Cool. Okay, sure. Well, you know, I was interested in psychedelics. I've always been interested in kind of corners of the envelope things, outre kinds of things, the exception that proves the rule. I was interested, you know, lots of young people are, in things like ESP and, you know, does God exist, and mm-hmm. stuff like that, the origins of the universe, and psychedelics included. I was when LSD really first started getting, you know, coverage in Time magazine, which is how I first read about it as a youngster in the 60s, you know, I was 14 or so, mm-hmm. and although not too young to take psychedelics, unfortunately, by today's standards, lots of too young people tend to take psychedelics without proper, you know, context,
mm-hmm.
I was not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested, fascinated, but scared.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I didn't take psychedelics until my freshman year of college.
Yeah, that's when I did as well.
Although all my friends were, you know, like in 10th grade when I was 14, it was 1966 and LSD was still legal.
Mm.
And so there were, I was in a sophisticated, you know, upper middle class community of Great Neck, Long Island, and lots of these, my friends had older siblings who were artists, perhaps, and, you know, there were lots of drugs, and LSD included. And I remember seeing somebody take a sugar cube of LSD, and you can see the dark little plume in the middle, mm-hmm. which is one drop from a dropper is about 1,000 micrograms. Mm-hmm. And so that's a whopping dose. And
that is a big dose.
It's like, for the audience, it's like about 8 times the clinical dose. And these kids would stay in class the whole day long.
Lord.
Tripping. Yes, exactly. Oh, Lord. But I didn't do that. I was like the designated driver. Mm-hmm. But in any event, so, you know, I got involved with psychedelics in college, really, and I was not involved, like an activist, but just mm-hmm. interested in taking them and, mm-hmm. you know, did my own personal exploration. I never really had a bad experience, but faded away as I left college and got into graduate school and didn't travel in the circles so much anymore. I was still very interested in the topic. I mean, psychedelics in the mind. I became a psychologist, of course, and so, you know, I was fascinated, but from afar. Mm-hmm. And I would talk to my best friend at the time, and, you know, gee, we wondered about whether people were still taking psychedelics, and then we'd see a news article about, you know, 500,000 hits of LSD seized. Mm-hmm. So we knew somebody was taking it, but it wasn't me. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I got to be about 40, I was introduced to MDMA, mm-hmm. and told to take it with my wife at the time, and I did, and it was really remarkable, as you might imagine, and very helpful in many, many ways, and it was a psychedelic. At this point I was a little over 40. It was not a psychedelic, I should say. It was a trip, though. Mm-hmm. It's a beginning and a middle and an end, and it was an altered state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Based on that experience, which was entirely positive, I decided I was going to take LSD for the first time in almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand, you know, what it was or what I didn't remember really what it was about. Anyway, I had a remarkable first experience of my adult life, I think of it as, with LSD that time. And, you know, people often think that the action of psychedelics is to give you bright colored lights or flashing, you know, visual distortions or strong emotions, to be giggling or fearful or terrified or things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that that's the action of LSD, let's say, for example. But that's not the action of LSD at all. The action of LSD is to illuminate. Uh-huh. That's all. It just shows you. It opens up, gives you clarity. Mm-hmm. All those other reactions are reactions to the action of psychedelics. So when you get tense and anxious, your vision tends to distort, and you tend to fixate on visual things rather than emotional things because it's easier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's lots of reasons why visual distortions begin to increase and grab your attention. And likewise with terror or giggling or joy or, you know, all the other things that people talk about as effective psychedelics. To me, those are just reactions to the action. The action is to illuminate, is to clarify, is to enable us to see without the occluding kind of distracting influence of, you know, our projective psychology, mm-hmm. you know, the way we wish it was, mm-hmm. and what we fear it wasn't, and, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. didn't get when we were children.
Yeah.
It's important for me to say, by the way, I don't use psychedelics in my clinical practice. Mm-hmm. I never have. And unless, you know, it's legal and I get official training, which is coming about, by the way, I will not be a psychedelic therapist mm-hmm. unless I do it that way, mm-hmm. because I'm not really qualified. And I also don't have the disposition for the risk involved. And besides which, I love public policy. I love influencing it. I love trying to, you know, help people see and educate and get on stage. And, you know, I love public speaking. So I couldn't really write books and do that sort of stuff if I had a secret practice.
Sure.
Yes. Found out eventually. Mm-hmm. So it's important for me to stress that I don't. But nonetheless, people come to me who are interested in psychedelics, who've read my book, and, you know, that's a very rich collaboration. I enjoy. Sometimes I say, well, you know, I can't tell you to take psychedelics, but if you're going to take a psychedelic, you know, come see me the day after. Mm-hmm. You know, when we can reap the real benefits of your insights and your openness. Mm-hmm. Because you can't do it legally, but, you know, if they happen to do it on their own, then, you know, you can certainly try to help them.
Sure.
It's also, by the way, this is about psychedelic parenting. Mm-hmm. It's also very important. I'm sure this has come up in prior podcasts, but you know that we're not talking here about giving psychedelics to your children.
Correct.
And although some tribal peoples have done that, and you know, there's some people make a logical defense of that. Nonetheless, that's not what this is about under current circumstances and current policy. And
right.
You know, some people will do it anyway, and I'm sure they'll be on your show and they'll talk about it bravely, and that would be interesting. I'd love to hear that podcast. But you know, I wanted you to understand that, you know, from my perspective at least, I've never given a psychedelic to my son, or yeah. You know, would I be interested in actually doing that?
Yeah, mostly we talk about the ways that our own experiences influence mm-hmm. how we interact with our children and their families and stuff.
Yes, exactly. And through that clarification and illumination process. Mm-hmm. And it's the exact same thing in the psychotherapy realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how psychedelics have influenced me and therefore changed the way I deal with my practice. So,
yeah, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your philosophy regarding childhood and how we build our personality? I think that's a very interesting topic.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's funny. It's like it's psychedelically derived. When I took that first trip of the adult era and had this, you know, revisioning, let's say,
mm-hmm.
Experience, it happened in a very visual way. And I've told this story many times. It's funny, actually, because I was so scared on this first trip after 19 years that I put post-it notes with reassuring statements on them around the apartment.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, don't worry, you'll be down soon, and
yeah.
You know, it's only a drug and things like that, and you're okay. So I closed my eyes as I started coming on to the first LSD I'd had in almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind's eye, I watched myself descend. I don't get high by going up. I descend deeper and deeper into myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so as I was going down, eventually, you know, there's this beautiful field of flowers, and I went down. I was below the ground. And below the ground, I saw these roots. And these roots were like possum tails. They were like animal, not plant. But I knew those were my roots,
mm-hmm.
my psychological roots. And because I was just coming onto the drug, I was still basically kind of had a straight mentality. I thought, oh, wonderful. Here's an opportunity. I'll go fix.
Mm-hmm.
And I zoomed in my mind's eye, my eyes were closed. I zoomed in. And my roots went, and with that screech, that upward sound, you know, also recoiled from my scrutiny.
Interesting.
And I knew that I was, you know, doing the wrong thing, being too picky or whatever, you know, trying to fix. And so I said, later for you, I turned my head and went down, continued my way down.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this glowing, throbbing mound at the bottom of me. And I knew that was the ground of my being,
mm-hmm.
like my soul, if you will. I'm not a religious person at all, so it was not a religious concept to me, soul, but it meant the deepest part of me,
mm-hmm.
the part I was born with, the mm-hmm. person I was born as, mm-hmm. before I developed personality, you know, mm-hmm. in a devil's bargain with my parents as Plan B, you know, Plan A is be myself, and since my parents didn't, you know, like some of it, but not certain parts of it, then I had to conform because I was a defenseless infant and they were big and neurotic. So, you know, there's no battle there. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's no question as to who has to succumb in one way or another. Although children are valiant, you know, they become rebellious, for example, or contrary, and that's their way of maintaining autonomy in the onslaught of, you know, parental, you know, press, parental neurosis. So in any event, so, you know, I, at the ground of my being, and when I went down to the bottom and I saw that and I touched it, it was all visual. And as I touched that glowing, throbbing mound, I felt okay. I felt a very, very fundamental, at the ground of me there, at the bottom of me, a fundamental sense of okayness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we should all feel, perhaps, like maybe we feel when we're first born, you know, before, again, our parents have had us. So, you know, and all of those, like the post-it notes, you know, it was like poignant and sweet and not real. it was the wrong question, really, in a way. It wasn't like, am I good enough? It's like, oh my God, why am I asking the question of, am I good enough? And that traces back to childhood. So, you know, there was this sense of being fundamentally perfect, fundamentally good enough. Perfect, like, you know, in the forest, every tree is got dry rot or, you know, infestation or hit by lightning. Mm-hmm. But the forest as a whole is absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. So every tree with all of its, you know, malformations is also, of course, perfect as well. Mm-hmm. So that was the way I felt about me. So when I came up and as I passed by, so to speak, those roots, this time, instead of zooming in to go pick and fix, I said, I get it. It's cool. You're fine. You know, I understand. And my roots went, and unfurled, you know, to be like really kind of stroked, so to speak, rather than picked at. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that then, I went into some detail here because that formed the foundation of my revised personality theory. I used to call it the core shell theory of personality, where the core is perfect, and that's how we emerge initially. Mm-hmm. And then in interaction with our parents, we cobble together a strategic, acquired, secondary, external thing we call a personality, and we identify with that. Mm-hmm. But it's really a misidentification because our true identity is that soul, that foundation that we were when we were born. And so, you know, I would tell my clients and do to this day about how we need to rediscover our truest self and disidentify with the shell, which is where the ego interfaces with the world. And that's so powerful. The ego is so effective. We love to watch the ego, and we love to sort of identify with it. You know, we can talk, we can categorize, we can argue. You know, wow, that's power to a baby. So we disidentify with the soul, and we identify instead with the shell, with the ego function. And you know, so the task of adulthood really is to wake up to that, to recognize. You know, it's all buried, of course, because it was painful, and sort of not to be fully accepted. And so we you know, to come to realize that again as adults, because now, and the key difference, of course, in psychotherapy is that, you know, you were a defenseless infant, and now you're an adult who's not defenseless at all.
Right.
So once you see it with love and allow yourself to see, that it's not terrible, it's not bad, and you're not bad, and so you can look at it more carefully, and you recognize that it was just a kid, you know, trying to get by the onslaught of parental neurosis, then you release it. You release it, and then you can start flowering, restart the flowering, of yourself.
Mm-hmm. So one of our five psychedelic family values is something that we call authentic expression. And it's about creating space for your children to be able to express themselves however they are, whether it be in regards to gender identity, sexuality, artistic creativity. And so that's something that you're speaking to is that sort of brings up a question in my mind. From your perspective, how can we as aware and awake parents trying to cultivate authentic expression in our children be conscious of the things that we do that help to build this false shell of personality and instead do things to cultivate that truest self in our kids?
Oh, well, it's interesting because the operant approach, doing stuff, cultivating as if we're a farm, is to me a reflection of Western civilization, industrial approach, that extractive, reductive, concentrative kinds of getting the essential element, the power thing out of the ground, getting the coal out and making it into steel, get wine and making it into vodka, and metaphorically concentrating things and getting the active ingredients out. That's this analytical, frontal lobe finger, you know, kind of complex that works together to pick and pick and pick the
mm-hmm.
thing that made my roots recoil, you know.
Okay.
So, and it results in a lot of functionality. Like you look out at society and we've got, you know, food, clothing, shelter, man, oh man, you know, we live to be in our 80s. But, you know, we've made it, you know, this duality, this Cartesian duality between, you know, spirit and matter
mm-hmm.
that's enabled us to kind of screw up the world because, you know, we've desacralized matter. And of course, quantum mechanics tells you that matter is really just patterned energy. And what's energy but another word for spirit?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, I have a very, you know, spiritual worldview that's completely mechanical and scientific, you know, like quantum mechanical
mm-hmm.
and relativistic, but still, you know, like I don't see it as supernatural in any way. I see mm-hmm. it just the way the universe works.
Mm-hmm.
And spirituality is the same thing. Spirituality is like, you know, embodied. It's always, you know, experienced by an animal. So spirituality is as natural as using the bathroom or breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really only one thing. And we're looking at it from two different perspectives. So I'm into healing Cartesian duality and this devil's bargain we made. I use that phrase a lot,
mm-hmm.
You know, in society of, you know, allowing, you know, pollution and extraction and organization, you know, got us to be, you know, live to our 80s, but alienated from nature. So
yeah.
we need to come full circle
mm-hmm.
and, you know, create a neo-pastoralism, really something mm-hmm. that, you know, anyway, so as far as being, you know, straightforward about that, you know, and with your children and whatnot, it's very important, mm-hmm. very important to do that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your own family life. Something that you shared with me earlier that I found really interesting was the living arrangements in your home after your divorce, and I think that it's very inspired by psychedelic thinking, and then I think that it could be an inspiration for other people. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, basically, you know, I cry a lot when, you know, I do psychedelics. I got in touch with my heart and soul,
mm-hmm.
with who I was, and, you know, it's very sad and poignant, and saltwater tears are so healing and warm, and, you know, I find the process to be natural but difficult. And so, you know, when I began to see more clearly how I was, you know, projecting my childhood, unresolved childhood issues onto my wife, and, you know, kind of that I'd gotten together with her really for the wrong reasons,
mm-hmm.
Fear-based reasons mostly. And, you know, I began to see more clearly, then I ultimately, you know, felt I had to leave the relationship. But I had a son
mm-hmm.
who I, you know, loved and love, you know, more than anything. And so mm-hmm. I, you know, there were several problems. First of all, I didn't want to leave him. I didn't want to spend less time with him at all.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I didn't want to hurt him
mm-hmm.
because, you know, his dearest wish was for his parents to get along. We never got along,
mm-hmm.
my ex and I. So, you know, we were fighting our childhood battles with each other, mm. our parenting issues. You know, she saw me as, you know, in terms of her father and whatnot, and I in terms of actually my older brother and mother.
Mm.
All this Freudian kind of like stuff that we weren't really in touch with. And as we became more in touch with it, I through psychedelics, and then she and I together through Imago relationship therapy. That's Imago. Which is a wonderful approach to couples work, Imago relationship therapy. We became more aware of it, and we recognized we needed to split. But again, I didn't want to lose my son,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want to hurt my son. And eventually, I came to recognize that the best parent I could be, the best I could do for my son, was for me to be the best me, and that I wasn't doing that. I was leading a lie. I was there was stress and anger and argumentation, and it was just a terrible environment for him.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was trying to preserve being with him 7 days a week and having it be a tense environment, to say the least,
mm-hmm.
Versus being with him half of the time and having that time with him be truly me, mature, happy, relaxed. So as we, you know, ultimately, you know, I felt like going to tell him this would be, you know, like stabbing him, walking over to my son and stabbing him. But, you know, ultimately, I came to realize it was the paradoxically really the best thing for me to do for him. So as we began to split, you know, we, again, I wanted to ease the impact on my son. And I said, listen, why don't we just keep the house? Why don't we, you know, I'm already in the city 2 days a week. You know, I'll stay away another day and you stay away, you know, a couple more days. She was up in Connecticut with her company, where her company was based, 1 day a week. And, you know, we can do it that way. And then Jared really won't have to, you know, leave. Mm-hmm. Originally, I proposed that in lieu of divorce, that we would just, you know, lead that life, which I'm glad we didn't do, because that would have been leading a lie and the marriage would have continued. But in any event, so we did this arrangement where we vacated that, instead of selling the big house and getting two smaller houses and have the kid go back and forth, the kids stayed put. And parents went back and forth. And ultimately, a parent of one of my son's friends said to me, oh, that's called a nesting agreement.
Nesting.
So a nesting agreement, yes, is what they call it, apparently. I discovered in retrospect. But, you know, it was just this natural thing. You know, my son had the same bedroom, the same dog, the same backyard, the same neighbors, same bus. It was so stabilizing for him, because kids really, you know, in a divorce, what they want to know is, what's going to happen to me? Right. They want to know, am I going to be, you know, am I going to have to go back and forth? Are you going to still be in my life? Am I going to, you know, be ridiculed? Am I going to, you know, be hungry? You know, I mean, well, are we going to have enough money? You know, it's really very self-focused. And
sure.
And rightly so. So I told him that very little was going to change, really. And he said, well, if it's not going to change, then I guess I'm okay with it. And in truth, that's exactly what happened. He was okay with it. Because it was okay with him, really. You know, it was. And I get along so much better with my now ex. Better than ever. And in part because I'm not trying to make her my love object, which was ultimately not, you know, what she was and what I needed, you know. So just having it be what it really was, and which is she's a good parent, she's smart, she really is very sincere and honest, and you know, there's so many great characteristics about her that I can appreciate now because I'm not blinded by this play that I was acting in without her consent, you know, projection.
Yeah. So when I first met you, in 2012 at the Psychedamia conference at UPenn in Philadelphia, and it was right after I had a reawakening of my own, coming back to psychedelics after being away from them for many years. Similar to you, I got interested in psychedelics as an undergraduate and then spent a lot of years doing other things. I was involved in, I worked for a retail pharmacy company, and then attended Psychedamia, and in that couple of years, my entire life has changed dramatically.
Wow.
Yeah, but when we first met, one of the things that you mentioned tied into also one of the things that really got me started in this work is that I have always been a big admirer of the talks of Terence McKenna and the writings, and he had a talk that I was listening to in 2012, and he was discussing parents not telling their children about their own use of, and he was specifically talking about cannabis, because Terence was a daily cannabis smoker, and he was sort of calling parents out on not being honest with their kids. And when you and I met, we had a conversation about the sort of cranky position that cannabis had in your own household, And so I'd like you to share that a little bit.
Well, cranky. Well, basically, I've smoked since I was about 14, mm-hmm. and it's always been really just a pleasure for me and something that I found valuable. Basically, cost beneficial for me, mm-hmm. in terms of, side effects versus benefits.
Yeah.
And so I've always, incorporated it into my life on a daily basis. And when I met my wife, she was very tolerant, God bless her, of that. She thought it was kind of cool or something. I'm not sure, but ultimately she was very liberal, lenient about that, and allowed me to, go off and smoke and whenever I wanted to, and without bugging me. It's one mm-hmm. of the nice things about her, actually, was that. And it just made life so much easier, because I'd been with girlfriends who, would nag me about it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So as time progressed, I was doing psychedelics. I was not doing psychedelics when I met her. Mm-hmm. And I began to do them, with her, actually, not the psychedelics, actually, but MDMA as a couple's work, and found it very valuable. And I proceeded down the path, and she really didn't. One of the reasons why we're not together today, I think, mm-hmm. is that we diverged.
From your son.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Lost my track.
That's okay.
Okay. So, as I say, I she was very tolerant about that, and that was a positive thing in our marriage. As time progressed and I became interested in psychedelics and was really introduced to them, sort of more for couples work, found it very valuable. I became more interested in psychedelics. She was also quite accepting, because I approached it from a very professional perspective. Mm-hmm. She could see the clinical uses. She was understanding that way. And then when my son was born, things really changed in a way. And it's kind of interesting, because as he grew older and, became 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and began to become, able to understand what smoking pot was,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to notice it, mm-hmm. and maybe even talk about it, my wife became very concerned. Mm-hmm. She didn't want the small community to ostracize him or me, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt that it was not a good influence on him, that he would perhaps start smoking sooner. Mm-hmm. And we do know that there's data showing that the earlier you smoke, the more addictive, the relationship becomes with cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily causative, however. It could be just correlative that, people who are more addictive, tend to want to spend more time with these things. So mm-hmm. in any event, in our marriage, we had what we gave each other what we called veto power. Because ultimately, you shouldn't be held captive in a prison just because you're married and you have to do something. So if it's really onerous and you just can't find your way clear to do something, you could veto that option, mm-hmm. and find what we call the third solution, mm-hmm. something, some compromise, some third thing that wasn't optimal for either of us, but at least wasn't onerous and objectionable. So in this case, I allowed her, gave her essentially veto power, because it was an important decision, and she was very, it was very emotional, and it's also illegal, and if it were not illegal, I perhaps would have different, I would have had a much stronger case, I guess, but mm-hmm. under the circumstances at that date, ultimately I had to acknowledge that this was illegal. So,
sure.
But the psychedelics part, she didn't care about, mm-hmm. as far as my son.
Mm-hmm.
I was going on, not just speaking engagements, but also, ceremonies and mm-hmm. retreats. And I would be very straightforward about that mm-hmm. as well. No gory details, but just, there was no hiding either.
Yeah.
To this day, I've been very open from the very beginning about my interest in psychedelics and my work my writing and my public speaking about them. And my son always knows when I'm on a speaking engagement, he's got a copy of my book, which he has not read, by the way. He's not interested. You know, he's, it's too much my big deal, my big thing. You know, it's my career choice. People read the book and comment on it favorably. And so it's, you know, I think he wants to be on his own, you know, out of his dad's shadow and, you know, just sort of succeed in his own way. And by God, he's a very successful young man. He's 16, but, you know, he's a very kind person, and he's an A student. As well, and you know, he's an athlete. He's interested in math and science, and he's great. So he's succeeding indeed on his own. You know, it's funny. At one point, he said to me, "You know, Dad. I said, why don't you do this? He says, no. I said, why don't you do this? He said, no. And I was learning not to say, why don't you do this? Because they gave him something to react against. And I finally said to him, Jared, you know, when you just say no to something that I suggest, you're not actually being you. You're just being not me. And, you know, being not me is kind of like the reciprocal of being me.
Right.
So it's still sort of being determined by who I am.
Yeah.
So, you know, you think that you'd agree with some of my stuff and disagree with some of my stuff, you know, so stop just being not me. Anyway,
my mentor in college was a philosopher and a professor of Indian religion, and he was a very spiritual guy, and did yoga every day and meditated, and his son was an MBA student when he was my teacher, and he came to my. He brought his son to my graduation party, and he introduced his son. He said, "This is my son, the MBA student." And he said to me, "So he said, it doesn't matter who you are. Your kids are always going to rebel against you."
Right.
And he said, "I'm hoping that he'll have some kids, and then I can recapture my grandkids with the double effect."
Right, I think that happens. It's true, but you know, actually, I think optimally though. If you have optimal parenting, like the average parent, there's never been a perfect person. Mm-hmm. So there's never been a perfect parent.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never been a perfect childhood. So it, quote unquote, imperfect childhood is really perfect because everybody's got, it's like an appendix, you know, it's like, you know, it's if everybody's got it, it can't be, you know, a disease. Otherwise it would have been selected out. Mm-hmm. And so the basically, you know, the purpose of neurosis, so to speak, that everybody has is to surmount it in a stepwise fashion, where you hit a wall and then you know a miracle occurs, if a change in phase, and you're up on the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything makes sense from that perspective, looking down. I'm sorry, ask the question again.
We were focusing on the cannabis relationship.
Right. Well, you know, that was something that he that I'd hidden from him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the behest of his mom.
Mm-hmm.
So I compromised, and right. I did like it. I had a friend of mine from high school who was a house husband. His wife was a physician, and he'd raised two children successfully, and he smoked in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the model I had always sort of assumed when I thought of myself as, you know, having children, that I would be, you know, myself in front of them, admonish them to, you know, be discreet because, you know, not everybody understood, and that it was an adult activity,
mm-hmm.
But that was not to be. So I ultimately agreed to not to hide it basically from my son.
Mm-hmm.
So years passed and we got to be about 15 or so. And one day I was up out on the terrace, and after all those years, he saw me smoking,
mm-hmm.
and he saw the lit ember, which I foolishly threw away,
mm-hmm.
because it was a visual thing, and he just followed it with his eye. I watched his eye move. It's funny. and I knew that he had seen it. So I went downstairs, and I after, you know, he left immediately, and I followed him down a minute later. And I said, "Look, Jared, you know, we need to talk. You know, I want to talk about what you just saw." He said, "Oh, I didn't see anything. You know, it was nothing." I said, "What do you mean? You didn't see anything? You didn't see me throw something away?" "No, I didn't see anything," which was, of course, he was just not ready to discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I let it be. And a couple of days later, his mom came to me and said, he said he saw you smoking and he thought it was a cigarette.
Oh.
And she said, so I just let that, you know, slide. I didn't really go out of my way to correct him. Which, you know, I understood, but it's sort of, I wish she hadn't because, I didn't really want him to think that I was smoking tobacco.
Yeah.
I'm not proud. I wouldn't be proud of smoking tobacco, which I don't smoke, but, you know, I'm not ashamed to smoke cannabis.
Sure.
So ultimately, about 6 months later, he happened to catch me again.
Mm.
Maybe I was at that point trying to be a little looser and, you know, get caught in some ways. I'm not sure. But he did catch me again. And at that point, it was obvious that it wasn't tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, we did talk. And I apologized to him, basically. I explained to him how it was not my style. It was not my intent. But, you know, I did it out of respect for his mom. And I'm not sure if it was the right thing. But, you know, it was the one thing I asked with him about.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt terrible about it. I told him so. And I apologized. And I told him it was not tobacco. Mm. I didn't want him to think I smoked tobacco. So, that was ultimately a union I had over that, or that I had actually with him, because I had deep feelings about it. I was not happy with being deceitful to him. And it was 15 years.
Wow.
Actually, the first few years I didn't have to be deceitful because I didn't know what I was doing. So, but nonetheless, it was a good dozen years.
Yeah.
And something that was very important to me that I respected and valued and was a part of my life. And, it was not a good way to, in fact, it was emblematic really in a sense of my marriage too, of, you know, leaving a lie, living a lie, so to speak, or a false self. And again, psychedelics, I think the action of psychedelics is not to create, you know, visual distortions or, terror or joy, but rather to just illuminate.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started seeing things more clearly, everything sort of came into alignment. It's almost like if you start thinking about your posture, the first thing you want to do is sit up straight.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you attend to it, you want to align.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be healthier. You want to, if you're not paying attention to it, you might slouch. But if you start talking about posture, you know, you want to straighten out. And yes, that's that's what psychedelics did for me.
Yeah.
And improved my relationship with my ex and with my now ex and with my son, like in manifold ways.
Mm, very interesting. So, and what was when you came out to him regarding your cannabis? What was his response?
Actually, you know, he wanted to know how much I smoked,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to basically understand brilliantly so. He wanted to understand my relationship with cannabis,
mm-hmm.
and how big a role it played in my life,
mm.
and what that role was. Was it positive or not?
Mm-hmm.
He was concerned with it in terms of health and, you know, safety and,
sure.
I guess, addiction too. Mm-hmm.
So we have a similar story in our house from our kids were a bit younger, but my wife has been a user of medical marijuana for quite a number of years now for a chronic pain condition. And she also mostly for secondhand smoke concerns would sort of go in the basement and to do her medicating. And she was downstairs in her crafting space. And we had just moved into a new house. And my son's bedroom had a knot in the hardwood floor that turned into a hole that you could see down into the basement. And all the children were playing in my son's bedroom, and I was sitting in the living room working on the computer, and all of a sudden all three children come running out of the bedroom with their arms in the air, "Daddy, Daddy, Mommy's smoking." And I'm like, oh no, now we got to have this conversation. But luckily, we had purchased an amazing book. It's called It's Just a Plant. And it's this great story of a little girl walking in on her parents smoking in their bedroom. And she's maybe 5 or 6 in the story. And they tell her what it is. And then the next day, her mom takes her on this tour of San Francisco, and they meet all these different people in the community that use cannabis in different ways. And they watch some police officers arresting someone on the street for smoking cannabis. And they go to a farmer's market, and this guy has a couple of plants in his booth in the back that he's hiding. And there's all these different perspectives on the ways that cannabis is used in society, and it presents it in a way like this is just this normal thing, and here's how society uses society interacts with it and stuff. And when it talks about the laws, the policemen aren't sort of portrayed as negative people. They're just like, well, it's against the law, so this is our job to like, you know, do this, and but we're not bad people. And it's a great book, and I would highly recommend it to anybody that's looking for ways to sort of breach this conversation with their young people.
Yes, you know, the concept of natural is really important, because all these problems are developmental stages and challenges that we hopefully surmount. You know, it's a beautiful and natural process, and that it's fear that makes us, you know, like sort of demonize the process, if you will, of discovery, because you know discovery always starts with you beating your head against the wall. With you being ignorant, in essence.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously, by definition, you know, if you knew it, you wouldn't be learning it.
Right.
So, you know, so that process of so to speak, failing, let's say at the beginning, is not really failure at all, because it's a step on the way toward mastery. Mm-hmm. It's like when a baby's trying to walk at first, it keeps falling down. You know, you have to clap. The baby fell down, and you're clapping. You're not clapping for the falling down. You're clapping for the process, for the
trying,
effort.
Yeah.
And you're making it a positive experience.
Uh huh.
Yeah. So you know, I think that's you know what we need to do with our kids. Mm-hmm. You know, with basically everything, let them discover. Get out of the way. Not be a farmer, but be a forest ranger.
Very nice.
You know, if lightning strikes, you know, then, you know, you call the fire department, they put out the fire. But short of that, you let nature tumble out and tumble forward.
Very interesting.
You trust the natural process in your child. So for me, you know, I think the best things about my son happened because I didn't, I wasn't running it. He was running it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like resource director, so to speak, you know, making sure that there was enough of everything. But he was the guy who was, you know, at my best, I was not trying to direct him. And he, because the process, it's not the fact of what he does or accomplishes, or it's the process that's the most important. If you reinforce learning, for example, you know, then it's got this compound interest effect over the course of his lifetime. So you have to make failure basically okay. That, you know, it's like fall, walk.
Yeah. Wow.
And as an adult, I tell my clients, it's like, you know, it's failed relationship, successful relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process that needs to be loved and, you know, valued through even the initial stages where, you know, you haven't attained mastery yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And parents, of course, need to have that attitude. That's where unconditional positive regard comes in. Mm. You say, you know, look, you're great. You'll do it. Just, you know, oh, you fell? Did you hurt yourself? No? All right. Well, you can, I'm sure, take care of yourself because you're capable.
Right.
And, you know, you can do this process.
Yeah. Awesome.
And if you need me, I'll be there. But, you know, I think you're awesome and you can do it on your own.
Yeah.
So this is all, for me at least, psychedelically facilitated or, you know, not enhanced in the sense of more insight, but just made easier, faster, smoother, more obvious. The whole process, for me, I think, of maturation, that I'm so grateful. One of the things I'm most grateful for in my entire life is being reintroduced to psychedelics, you know, as an adult. I mean, I have such gratitude to, I don't know, the universe for the fact that I could, lots of my friends don't take psychedelics. And I, you know, I'm just so grateful that, that I encountered these marvelous, natural, you know, aids, mm-hmm. aids to loosening up the prior self, having mm-hmm. a mini death, if you will, and rebirth mm-hmm. in the new configuration of maturity or the new stage of life, from going from child to adult, from adult to parent, from parent to grandparent. You know, those stages, the stepwise developmental stuff that, you know, Piaget and all those guys talked about, that we go through, had traditionally been facilitated by these loosening agents, mm-hmm. by psychedelics that would enable you to, you know, see through, to loosen, to have ego death, so to speak,
right.
about your prior configuration.
Mm-hmm.
Your stance with which you face the world would die and then get replaced by the next stage of life. But now in our world, you know, they don't have psychedelic visionary plants to aid in the rites of passage. So we walk around with our childhood baggage into adulthood
mm-hmm,
instead
yeah.
of seeing through it with the aid of a psychedelic as it's meant to be. It's meant to be in part of society. It's meant to be part of our cosmology. It's meant to be part of our spiritual rituals.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be part of our developmental process
yeah.
as animals. We co-evolve with these plants.
Yeah, I agree. We have a disturbing lack of rites of passage in our culture. One of the things I also on the side do, I do like ride sharing. And so I give, you know, college kids rides home from the bar and it's nice,
so nice
to get
yeah.
them to do that. But, you know, I get to observe the damage that the lack of rites of passage in our society for young
right.
people, the damage that wreaks, because what we end up left with is binge drinking as a freshman and, you know, throwing up in a taxi cab and
yeah. And we don't have rites of passage
right.
because we, you know, we've de-religified society and, you know, unfortunately, but mostly because, you know, we don't have support of our parents, of our families.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be secret. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like if you look at the rite of passage in the tribal setting, you know, metaphor, the parents are there,
yeah.
you know, the uncle's there, the police officer in the form of, let's say, the tribal chieftain is
yeah.
there,
mm-hmm.
the psychiatrist and the priest in the form of the shaman, let's just say,
right.
You know, are there as well. All the authority figures in society, you know, their equivalents are there when you're taking drugs, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a good
because
point.
It's not drugs, you know, they call it medicine
mm-hmm.
or sacrament.
Right. Before we run out of time, I did want to touch on something that we mentioned in conversation before. And you were talking about some work that you've done at a local high school speaking at a career day.
Yes.
Would you like to tell our listeners more about that?
Sure. Sure. Well, it was a neighboring school system, middle school. I was invited to come in and do a career day. I think they got my name from a local hospital where I was on, you know, file for referrals. And so I explained to them that, you know, I didn't go into great detail, but, you know, I was just sort of curious. I didn't want to completely nix it. I didn't know how they'd respond. But I did come clean about the fact that I was focused on drug policy
mm-hmm.
and drug policy reform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I may have even said psychedelic therapy, or I'm not quite sure exactly how forthright I was, but I gave them enough of a heads up. And they said, no, that's fine. We were interested in drug policy and drug policy reform.
Interesting.
Right. So, you know, I went and gave my talk, and I talked quite openly about how I became a psychologist. And I talked about the field of psychology, which is a wonderfully, you know, flexible career to be in. You can be in corporate, you can be in industry, you can be teaching, you can be a consultant, or you can be a writer or a therapist. There's so many different career roles. It's really, you know, amazing. And I love the field of psychology. And so I talked about that. But I also talked about my own story and how I took, you know, I think I softened it up because these were like seventh and eighth graders.
Sure.
But I was nonetheless straightforward about it. The teachers didn't bat an eyelash.
Wow.
And I was invited back the next year.
Nice.
And so I continued to do this for several years. I think I changed my address, actually. I think sort of lost touch with me. But it was to their credit. You know, it surprised me, actually, that they were, that I got asked back the second year.
Yeah. I think that sort of hacking or reprogramming things like youth drug education in schools is a really big place where psychedelic parents can have a profound impact on their larger communities. You know, getting involved in when your kids start to, if they're, you know, if your school uses like DARE or some kind of horrible thing like that, is, you know, kind of getting in there and talking to the principal and talking to the teachers and saying, like, you know, what are the other alternatives to this? This is the things that I see are misinformation that we're giving our children. And, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to find alternatives, and there are some alternatives that are, that try to focus on things like good choices, but, you know, there really aren't what I would call like the earwood.org for eighth graders kind of experience. And I think that's a big gap in our society that I really hope, you know, I don't have the time to fill it, but I really hope there's somebody out there that's can be inspired to create something like that, because I think it's desperately needed in our society.
I think that, you know, we're not going to resolve our drug problem, especially with kids, until we, you know, I'll say it, you know, but in quotes, you know, quote, teach our children how to take drugs.
Yes.
End quote. Because I mean that to be, you know, provocative, but what I'm saying is that, you know, until they understand the proper role and function, you know, process of LSD and why and where it might be useful or helpful. Mm-hmm. And until they know about heroin and how it might be helpful in hospice, for example, until we're honest with the entire civil, you know, the population, including the children, about what the truth is really about, you know, the role and function of various drugs. Until we do that, then they're not going to be making healthy, wise decisions not to take drugs. 100%. They need to understand how they work.
Yep.
In order to make the decision, I don't want to access that function.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to ease my pain and avoid, you know, whatever, you know, you might say about heroin. I don't want to make that choice. And then, you know, there will be people in a libertarian society who decide to, you know, use these substances anyway, but hopefully, you know, they would have pure sources with doses that were known, and they, because of their education, would also know what dose they were going to use to abuse.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't die as much.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a chart which on drugs which shows lethality crossed by addictive potential. Mm-hmm. And up in the upper right-hand corner, the highest of both, was heroin. Mm-hmm. But heroin chemically is not that toxic. It's not as toxic as methamphetamine, for example, or cocaine. Mm-hmm. But more people die from it because of impurities, because of overdoses, because of public policy, essentially, that keeps it illegal and illicit and secret. So with education, it's really, education is not telling somebody what to do. Education is really like informing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Like having a library is the core of education. And then people, you know, make their own choices, but hopefully they're more mature ones when they have the facts.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere recently that quite a significant number of, like, recent heroin overdose deaths are actually because, like, people thought they were taking heroin and it turned out they were getting fentanyl.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
And the same thing's true with MDMA. With Molly or ecstasy, with they're getting something. Jeez, I don't even know what it is. Methylone or shush, I'm mispronouncing it.
It's
methylone, I think is what it is. Uh-huh. And when you look at the data from the EDM concerts where people, you know, died from what was supposed to be Molly, they died in two ways. Either they died from taking, you know, a regular amount or a little bit a double amount of something that wasn't MDMA,
mm-hmm.
or they died by taking like 6 or 8 doses of MDMA.
Yeah.
And it's very, very simple. You know, there's good research data that should be promulgated that, you know, although certain substances have no lethal limit, there's never been a death associated with LSD or marijuana. Mm-hmm. Other substances like MDMA are indeed toxic at only slightly higher doses.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needs to know this. This is information. Nancy Reagan famously said, just say no to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the wise people know that it's just say K-N-O-W.
Right, yes.
You have to know.
Yeah.
Do your homework. That's what I tell when kids ask me some questions. I say, well, you got to do your homework.
Yep. I always, always send people to earwood.org because I think that it's an amazing resource and it's very balanced, you know, and people who are going to be sort of scared off by trip reports or things like that, you know, may not appreciate it, but you know, they can still look, there's things about dosage and lethality.
I tell them the same exact thing. Yeah. I tell them to avoid the trip reports.
Yeah.
I say trip reports are bogus because it's an N of one and it's also poly drug usually. It's not just the effect of one drug. And so, you know, it's so influenced by other things like personality when you have an N of one. So I said the trip reports are like how stoned I got last weekend. Forget about that stuff. But the staff written assessments of dosage and duration and dangers are medical school quality.
Yeah,
as good or better than anything written by the government, generally better. So I send them there, and I send them to PCOL and TCOL,
mm-hmm.
and I send them to Psychedelic Drugs Reconsidered
mm-hmm.
by Grinspoon and Bacalar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if you've met Earth and Fire Earwood, but they're great people. My wife and I want to be them when we grow up.
They're wonderfully committed, active people. They've spoken at Horizons more than once. But
uh-huh.
We've had them in to do the State of the Stone.
Uh-huh.
And they update on, you know, what's happening with synthetic marijuana, which is, by the way, a total misnomer because most of the synthetic marijuanas have no chemical structural similarity to marijuana. They just happen to have an experiential effect that's similar to the effect of marijuana.
Interesting.
But they're not synthetic THC,
right?
Because they're not chemically related at all. Another nomenclature thing that needs to be said is about the words Molly and ecstasy, and how when MDMA first came out, it was packaged, marketed as ecstasy,
mm-hmm.
and then it became readily adulterated. You know, the data show that 90% of ecstasy has something else in it.
Mm-hmm.
And 50% of ecstasy has no MDMA in it at all.
Golly.
So, yeah, so it's highly adulterated. And the reason why is because MDMA is costly to manufacture.
Mm.
And something like LSD is much cheaper to manufacture. And methamphetamine is cheaper to manufacture.
Right.
So, you know, they've been contaminating it. So after it got a bad reputation, then the dealers introduced it in a new form. It came in powdered form.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it Molly.
Interesting.
And they said, well, it's powder. It's fresh out of the lab. You know, it's mm-hmm. not even in pill form yet, which is so silly because it's so much easier to adulterate something when it's still in powdered form. So, you know, but Molly is supposed to be MDMA and ecstasy is supposed to be MDMA. And it's gotten to the point where the adulteration is so widespread and so expected and accepted that the kids now almost have a different definition for Molly. Molly is sort of like a smorgasbord drug or like a hybrid or a mixture type thing.
Interesting.
It's got a lot of stuff in it. It's just strong.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a real shame because, you know, MDMA has a specific effect that's quite, you know, helpful under certain circumstances.
Indeed, yeah. Well, Neil, I'd like to say thank you so much for sitting down and having this conversation with me. It's been wonderful. Before we part, let's just mention again Horizons. It's coming up next weekend, the 9th, 10th, and 11th of October. I will be giving a talk on reclaiming religious freedom and family values. And Neil, you'll also be giving a talk on what again?
It's called Psychedelics and Death. a brief introduction. But you know, there's so many other topics being discussed. I want to, you know, maybe share with you briefly.
Certainly.
But I want to also give you the URL, which is horizonsnyc.org.
Great. And I will also put that in the program notes for all of our listeners to be able to have access to.
So on Saturday, we have kind of a much more research-oriented day. As I say, it's research-oriented but not academic. It's meant for the general public. So we have a talk on the use of psilocybin for addiction, another talk on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, when it's going to be approved for prescription use. There's a talk by a neuroimaging brain scientist on psychedelics in science and medicine. Wow. There's another talk on ayahuasca. Another neuroimaging guy is going to talk about ayahuasca awareness and depression.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, you know, there's a wonderful project using psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety at NYU and Johns Hopkins and UCLA. And so folks from those studies will be there to talk about psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, meditation, mystical experiences in the brain. And there'll be a film shown, first-person narratives, people talking about their personal experiences. And the Sunday is a little bit more big picture or policy-oriented. So we have a wonderful woman named Charlotte Walsh coming to talk about psychedelic drug policy activism, why cognitive liberty matters.
Mm-hmm.
And then, John, you're going to be talking about reclaiming religious freedom and family values. And we have a researcher from the NYU study talking about reuniting with oneself in the face of cancer, a very poignant talk.
Mm.
Another one talking about studying the recreational use of these drugs, psychedelics, partying, and policy is her talk.
Awesome.
And then, you know, I'll talk about psychedelics and death. And then we'll close with Daniel Pinchback, who will talk about psychedelics and deep ecology.
Mm.
How the psychedelic perspective is intimately tied to the way we treat the planet. And we'll close with an all-speaker panel discussion. So Saturday night, by the way, there'll be a benefit and a dance. And Friday night is an opening reception at the Rubin Museum, which is free of charge, by the way.
Awesome.
So you don't have to buy a ticket to the conference to come to the Rubin opening reception on Friday evening at the Rubin Museum.
Come and schmooze with interesting people.
Come and schmooze with us, yes, indeed. So thank you for, again, for bringing me on and for giving me the opportunity to tell people about Horizons.
Yeah, it's been an honor, and I look forward to seeing you next weekend.
Yeah, same here.
All right.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.